Today on the Inside Flap.
Well, then we all got pulled from those missions to go protect the Inner Meraki government, who all had a gigantic bullseye on them. Mm-hmm. And this is about the time when IEDs are starting to show up over there. We thought, oh, wow, we don't have any training for this. A couple guys did, not everybody. And now we're supposed to go and essentially do a Secret Service type job protecting some of the most hated people in the world in a war zone. It's such a pain.
Yeah, I would imagine. Gosh,
it's such a pain. Yeah. Like, they take out things that are not classified in any way whatsoever. In Savage Sun, they took out something that I've known since probably 7th or 8th grade. It's ridiculous.
The Inside Flap is available on demand every week on iTunes, Stitcher, the Google Play Store, and around the world on theinsideflap.com.
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus. Welcome to the show. Seated across the table to my left is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
Howdy. And a scraggly-looking fella coming across my Skype 3 miles downriver is Andrew Dowd. Andrew.
Excelsior.
Well, that beard is really coming in, looking good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, look at that.
Yeah. Wow.
Just call me Grizzly.
Yeah, I was just going to say, look like Grizzly Adams over there.
Yeah.
All right, welcome to the show. This is
The Inside Flap.
The Inside Flap Podcast, episode 72. Our special guest this week is Jack Carr, former Navy SEAL and author of the James Reese novels, including his latest, The Excellent Savage Son. We'll have that conversation for you just shortly. Laura and I talked to him, and you know, he's a real great guy, and he's got a great radio voice.
Oh, yeah.
Who would have known? He had a very, very nice radio voice. Face made for the radio. No, I don't know. We didn't really couldn't see him while we were talking.
I think he's probably a nice looking fellow.
I'm sure he is.
And it probably doesn't matter because he's a former Navy SEAL who also can write good thrillers.
So I guess
I think
it really
he's doing just fine.
What he looks like. All right. Today's show is brought to you by IndieBound. Make sure you're supporting your independent booksellers. You can go to our webpage, theinsideflap.com, click through the link. To get to IndieBound, it does not cost you a cent, but it does help to support the show while at the same time supporting independent bookstores. So please go ahead, do that. Here we are in day, what is this, about day 3,000, I think, of lockdown.
That's
and
right.
Listen, all right, here's one thing. I wanted to just complain about this for a little bit.
When you said that,
yes.
You looked at me and I thought, oh no, I hope it's not about me.
It is not about you. Okay. It's about the damn supermarkets. Now, you'd think they'd have enough time now. It's a good solid month into this quarantine. You'd think that they're the only place where you can get some food. You'd think they'd have time to figure it out. Now, we don't, for obvious reasons, we're not going out into the soup. Well, maybe not for some people. Apparently, I've talked to a number of people who don't think it's obvious, but we are not going into supermarkets. We're getting online. We're placing our orders, and it's always like 3 or 4 days out ahead of time, so you got to think ahead, but we've been building those orders. You can edit it up until the time it's go, then boom, go there, park, they come out, bring your groceries to you, throw it in the back of the truck, boom, bam, and you're good to go. However, and that's with our local grocery store, King Supers, right down the corner here. Last time, or the time before last, there were a lot of weird substitutions, and they were mysteriously out of items like cheddar cheese. I don't know what if there was a run of Wisconsinites here in town. They couldn't get their cheddar cheese, but there was no cheese for us. So we thought we would give Walmart a try.
Have you tried Walmart, Andrew? Or do you guys still go in, don't you?
No. Mostly it's Target for us.
Oh, really?
Do you do
the pickup?
We're doing most of our grocery shopping with Target.
I haven't tried that.
Pickup or in the store?
Delivery.
Oh, delivery.
Oh fancy. Yep. Fancy, dear Andrew. There we go.
Delivery.
There's that music, chamber music.
We're really roughing it here. Like today, yes. Katie decided that she's in a baking mood. So she made homemade cinnamon rolls. She made the dough herself. And she proofed it in the oven. And she made these melt-in-your-mouth cinnamon rolls.
Wow.
homemade icing and everything. So they were phenomenal.
They literally
do melt in your mouth. That's how good they are. Mm. So
lovely.
It was a good day for baking too, just because it was cold and snowy again. Thank you, Denver.
Yeah, cold and snowy. We're chowing down on some Reese's peanut butter eggs. So that's what we got going on over here. Delicious. Anyway, okay, so I was a little dissatisfied with King Soopers. Decided to give a Walmart a try. Massive mistake. Placed an order online, and the pickup day was 3 days in the future, which is about par for the course, I guess, nowadays. So we got the notification that the order came in. So I start driving over to the Walmart, which, by the way, I thought the Walmart was the one just 5 minutes down the road. Oh, no, that is not a super Walmart. As I got in the truck and my Google Maps informed me to hunker in, because the Walmart that I was now heading to was a good solid 20 minutes away.
Also, I was the one who selected the Walmart, and I heard so many bitter complaints directed towards me.
Well, I don't think you heard half of the ones that were inside.
That's probably true.
But, you know, there was no problem driving 20 minutes.
Body language.
I had the great new Don Winslow audiobook, Broken, to listen to, and you will hear that, actually more about that later in the
audiobook of the week
segment later in the show. So, anyway, I drive over to the Walmart, pull into the parking lot, and Now, as you pull into the store, there is a giant sign painted on the building itself. It's not even a sign. It's just letters, block lettering painted on the Walmart, and it says pickup. Six massive letters, pickup. Massive, massive wording painted right there on the building. You cannot miss it. So I'm like, okay, great. I'll go right here to the pickup. Pull into a spot. And then there's no sign there. You know, the King Supers, there's a little sign, call this number. There's no sign there. There's nothing. There's a couple of cars to my left, to my right. Nobody's sitting in those cars. I'm like, what's going on? Am I supposed to just wait here? I don't have an app. My phone, I had broken my phone, so I didn't have, I was using my old iPhone 5, and it didn't have the capability to run the Walmart app. That they want you to download and use. So I called up Laura. I'm like, what's going on? Do you have an order number? So she texted me the order number. And then I'm like, all right, well, let me go inside and see what the hell is going on here. Now,
the other thing is, too, the email that I got from Walmart, they gave specific pull-up instructions, like where to go and whatever. And I started reading those to you.
I was just going to say, I asked for
before you left the house, and you were so annoyed that it was the other Walmart.
When I found
that
out,
that you waved me, you waved at me, waved me aside, and you said, I'm going to go get it.
Okay, well, yes. I mean, I was in a hurry. Mm-hmm. All right, so I get out of the truck. Well, you still didn't give me those instructions.
So, Dave, hang on a second.
Yes.
I thought you were in the right spot. I didn't know.
What the hell were you in a hurry for? I mean, come on. We're waiting at home. You're driving somewhere only to get back home and wait some more. What?
He spends an hour a day on his job.
There are things if you don't find something that you need to be in a rush for, then what the hell are we living for? You got to find something that you got to be rushing around for. Anyway, I get out of my truck, and immediately, a good sign, I'm seeing everybody who's walking towards the entrance, and this was a fair amount of people. But everybody's wearing masks, and several people are wearing gloves, but most people are wearing like a bandana, or they've got a hospital mask.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of masks. Maybe 90% of the people.
I feel so self-conscious with a mask on. I know I'll get used to it.
Yeah, very
self-conscious.
I'm
going to have to get used to it if I want to go out anywhere, but it's a strange feeling.
It is. And the other good thing I saw was that the entryway going into the Walmart was roped off, kind of like a Disneyland corral style, all the way through, so they kind of funnel you through it so you can be in a sign saying stay 6 feet behind other people. So I'm like, okay, great. This is no problem. But there is a problem. And the problem is the guy who's greeting you, the Walmart greeter. Now, ordinarily, every other time I've been to a Walmart, these guys are always got a mask on, but it's an oxygen mask. Now, this guy is completely sans mask, and he's asking me if I need assistance as I have to walk literally like 2 feet past him as he's standing right there in the entranceway. So I'm like, pick up, as I'm trying to like breathe to the right. And he's like, what do you need? I'm like, where's pickup? And he gestures to a big TV monitor in the store there.
Oh.
So I walk over to this TV monitor and there's a sign saying pickup over the top of it.
Huh.
I stroll over there. My bandana is firmly entrenched over my own mouth.
My
red bandana.
Andrew, what are you wearing to cover your mouth?
Well, I mean,
you haven't probably.
I've got painter's masks. So I have some masks.
Painter's masks are good. That's a really good one.
We might have some of those.
Really not going out, so I've had occasion to use it once or twice.
Right.
I've been wearing a Colorado buff with the state flag on it, but it's tight when I pull it up, so I really can't like speak or breathe. Yeah. So it's problematic.
Well, I'm like, I've got the bandana and I'm like holding it over because now I'm worried. After seeing this Walmart greeter, I don't know what the hell is going on.
So you're touching the...
So now, I've got to start punching in my order number on the clearly infected keyboard where no doubt,
COVID-covered keyboard.
Dozens of other people had punched in their own order number. About halfway through punching in the number, when all of a sudden a Walmart associate materialized as if right out of thin air, like out of some kind of virus vapor. She pops up right next to me asking me if I need to help. I mean, good luck trying to find help in a store before the pandemic. But now all of a sudden, everybody wants to be my best friend.
That's true.
And they want to do it from 3 inches away from my face with, by the way, if you haven't guessed it before, yes, no mask on.
They don't wear masks, do they?
There's no mask.
Yeah.
So I start, I'm like.
There's no law yet.
No, there isn't, but it's strongly suggested. So I started slowly backing away from her, telling her I was putting my order in for pickup, and then immediately her face drops and she gets mad. Now, I don't know if it was because I was backing away from her or what, but she starts giving me a little sass, some old Walmart sass. She's shaking her head vigorously. And now, of course, now I'm imagining like these COVID particles flying off her head like projectiles coming at me. And she points outside and tells me to drive all the way around to the back of the store where the pickup was.
Why do you think if I worked at a place like that, because I needed to, and I understand why people are working, because it's a risk, but maybe it's better than, homelessness or the food line or stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't you protect yourself, I wonder? Do they just not know?
Absolutely no
also,
idea.
If I was a supervisor there, I'd make sure my employees knew how to protect themselves the best way they could.
Well, and not just themselves, but all the other people walking into the store. That's the whole point.
I know,
of
but if you're
masks.
In charge of people, you do care about them and you want to make sure they're protected.
I would think
and
there's
like,
be,
you're right, the people coming into your store, of course.
A lot
too.
Of OSHA related lawsuits that are going to be filed for unsafe working conditions.
Yeah.
I don't know why they're not provided with masks.
Huh.
Hmm. Anyway, so she tells me I gotta drive all the way to the back of the store, and I go outside where my truck is parked by the 50-foot-high neon orange sign painted on the store. So I guess I was just supposed to ignore that. Got in the truck, drove all the way around to the back of the store, and that's where... they had like a whole gang of people just like scuttling back and forth with all the sacks of groceries.
And
somebody was right there for me, ready. Of course, half the order was substituted for
other
stuff.
If you hadn't been mad at me for picking the further away Walmart, we could have talked.
Maybe we could have talked. Maybe a lack of communication that was going on, but I don't know. I do know that the guy loading up my truck was also not wearing a mask. I mean, what is going? Am I crazy?
No.
Am I just overreacting? Why? I have no idea. I don't know. But I do know the important thing was that the double stuffed Oreos were in the order.
Oh,
so that's that's the most
That's my quarantine happy. Treat.
Yes,
happy
the double stuffed Oreos.
I don't have a Katie Dowd in my life to make me sweet treats. So I got to buy them, Andrew, but my sweet treat is that. Yeah.
Yes. Nothing like warm from the oven.
I know. That sounds amazing.
Yes.
Really does, especially on a cold, snowy morning.
Yep. But Laura, how has your week been?
Oh, well, I purchased something at the end of this year.
I made a little purchase, did you?
And it is, I was so excited about this purchase, and it's essentially useless right now. Not a big purchase, but I could have spent a lot. So last year, I was with a client, and we were going to make a, you know, another appointment. So I pulled out my phone, because I keep my calendar on my phone.
Mm-hmm.
And then she pulled out her day timer, day planner. And so she had a paperback, wire-bound day planner. It was really pretty. It had all kinds of, like, inspirational quotes and, like, day-by-day stuff and organizing sheets and stuff. And I'm always looking for new ideas on how to get organized,
because
it's a job
organized.
Where you've got a lot of different plates in the air spinning.
Yes. You got to be on top.
And you
got to
keep
stuff.
Pushing those plates around.
Yes.
And I was so excited about this. She talked to me about it. I asked her about it. She sent me a link to her particular day planner.
Yeah.
We geeked out on day planners for a little bit.
Right.
So I did a lot of research on day planners, found one that would fit with my industry, with what I do and what I needed to write down.
Mm-hmm.
Got the day planner, and it was working like magic up until, let's say, March 17th.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would always have the paper day planner out.
What
with
a
my,
worthless purchase.
With my notebook and my laptop. And then today, the very first day, I was like, why am I? I didn't even bother getting it out. It's just sitting there.
Yeah.
It's empty. It's empty.
Mm.
Yeah.
Completely.
So that was one of those purchases that I was so pumped about. And it's completely useless right now.
Yeah. What are you going to do with it?
Well, nothing.
I started a nice fire with it.
You know, I started writing conference calls and stuff on it.
Yeah.
But they're not that elaborate, and it's not a lot of different things I need to juggle. So I can just put those on my phone. So I don't really need to handwrite anything out and put it in my phone at the same time like I did before, because I needed the backup because I had so many things going on.
I guess it's like buying the Complete Idiot's Guide to Gallagher, because you don't really, also not something you really need.
So how are you, Andrew?
Andrew, how has your week been?
Well, I mean, just working from home, and it's been a long slog.
Mm-hmm.
One day I actually had to go in the office because I waited. My password needed to get reset on my computer. And so, of course, like an idiot, I waited until the day that it needed to change. And unfortunately, because the password needed to be reset, I couldn't log into my computer. I couldn't get onto the company network. So I had to go physically to the company.
Oh.
Now, this is a place where normally like 8,000 people work.
Hmm.
And I did not see one employee. I saw the security guard at the front desk.
Mm-hmm.
There was not a soul in the entire building. I didn't see one person.
Wow.
And they had actually started to put like sanitizing Purell stuff all over the place there.
Wow.
So
did you snag a couple?
I just had to go in, you know, and nobody there. And it was kind of like,
grab some toilet paper.
To stay there and work in my cushy office.
Oh, I bet you did. And there's toilet paper in the restroom and hand sanitizer.
Everything you need. You
could bathe in that
and
stuff.
Peace and quiet and a nice little setup. And I'm just sitting there thinking, like, nostalgic. I'm like, oh man, these are the days. Those were the days. but it was so funny visiting it. And so on the way out, I told the security guard, it's too loud here. I can't get anything done. and then I walked out the door.
That's cute.
Yeah, he didn't. He didn't try to get you to stick around for a little company.
No. He's from a different country, and he was talking to somebody in a different language. So I left him to his own devices.
Mm-hmm. Now, literally,
that's a good job right now.
I'm sending Laura and Dave. I'm sending you a picture.
Mm-hmm.
So Dave, if you want to pull that up and show that to Laura.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a tree taken down today. Now, of course, Peter has some of his decorations.
Nice ringtone, Dave.
Up on the front porch. And we had a crew in there today cutting trees down, a tree in our backyard. A sober crew.
Okay. Also, I got to point out a non-socially distancing crew also.
Yeah, look at this crew.
They look like, they look like guys from Mad Max.
With each other, going to work. They're in the truck together, coming home from work. So if obviously they're not social distancing. But,
ride together, die together, huh?
Laura, maybe you want to describe the picture that they took after cutting the tree down?
Well, first of all, it's 1, 2, 3. So it's five guys. And if you can picture the cast of Mad Max with chainsaws, sunglasses, a little bit of face mask, ski goggles, fur caps. I mean, it is a motley crew. And they're posing with a creepy, creepy Pennywise.
Oh, yeah. Peter's Pennywise,
like,
animatronic.
The scariest Pennywise I've ever seen in my life. And these guys are chainsawing it up. There's gang symbols being shown.
I mean, they're geared up. Like, I didn't know this is a Halloween picture.
That's a ride or die crew right there. Yeah.
Well, that's what they, I mean, that's the proper equipment for cutting down trees, safety equipment. And, you know, and so Peter was thrilled that they loved his Pennywise. They wanted to take a picture with it. Now, I will tell you, the only thing scarier than watching those gentlemen pose with Pennywise and chainsaws was last week they were cutting down my neighbor trees. And when they were done, they just decided to play some basketball in the front window outside my house.
Uh-huh.
And the only thing scarier than them standing with Pennywise is watching them attempt to play basketball. they need to stick with their day jobs.
Oh, man.
Boy, these guys didn't get the memo. What kind of trees are they cutting down?
They're really showing off their chainsaws.
You guys got some dead trees over there?
Well, let me...
A lot of tree cutting that's always going on over at Andrew's house.
I will send you a video.
Getting to the bottom of this.
And so the problem is we have is with the pine trees, you cannot grow grass. And so we took this tree down because we want to be able to grow grass on the hill. And we cannot grow grass with the tree that was there, right? So we took it down basically because obviously our yard's not big enough. So we need to grow some more grass.
Ah, gotcha.
Are you talking like marijuana or... Kentucky bluegrass.
We're talking rye or bluegrass.
I mean, you took that tree down. Oh, that's a huge pine tree. Well, your neighbors have a better view.
Well, and that's they're trying to sell their house, so it should open up their view. But and we also think about putting for the kids. What do they call those things? A 150-foot zip line.
Yeah.
For the kids, and so that way that will let us do that.
Yeah, that'll be fun. That's hours of enjoyment right there, the zip lines.
Mm-hmm. And so, doing something good for the environment.
It's all good. We've had snow for like the last 24 hours here, and it is beautiful. And you got to appreciate the precipitation. Anybody that lives in Colorado knows that it is an arid climate, and I appreciate the precipitation, but boy, I wish winter was over.
Yeah. Yep, ready for it to be over, indeed.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. All right, well, our guest this week is former Navy SEAL Jack Carr. His new book is Savage Son, and it is a damn good thriller. Listen, I raced through this book. I raced through this book like a shopper through an infected Walmart. This one flew by, jam-packed with action, international intrigue, duplicitous double agents, Russian spies, but what this book really boils down to is the thrill of the chase. Now, let me ask you this, Andrew. What would you rather be, the hunter or the hunted?
I think I would rather be the hunter.
Okay. All right. Well, this book goes a long way.
I was going to say the hunted.
I have no idea. Well, I kind of like running, so, sometimes I feel like...
Oh, really?
Yeah, especially when you're in a race, you feel like you're being hunted, and it's good. And there's a lot of that idea in this book, and we talked to Jack Carr about that, all about man's primordial instinct to stalk, to hunt, to prey, maybe not to be hunted. Yeah. So this book centers on the character of Navy SEAL Lieutenant Commander James Reese, who is recovering from brain surgery when the book opens with his family and friends in Montana, unaware that he is being hunted by the Russian mafia. The story goes back and forth between Jack and the Russians, and when they do come after him, that's when the book really takes off. From there, the scene shifts to the Arctic, and the action ratchets up exponentially. There are parachuting dogs, agonizing torture scenes, and a juicy sociopathic bad guy. Now, what I really liked about this book is just the knowledge that Jack Carr writes with. He knows, because he's been there, so he knows of what he writes. Here's a guy who spent 20 years in active duty and someone who has commanded special ops task units around the world. He really knows his stuff. And more importantly, he knows how to take that and work it into a story that's not only just credible, but is great storytelling. It's suspenseful. And it's action that arrives with the force of a sledgehammer and the speed and cunning of an Arctic fox. But you know what? Mm. is not as cute as an Arctic fox. Seriously, if you just Google Arctic foxes, those things
are really
I don't know
cute.
If you've spent any time. I went down a deep rabbit hole looking at some
I have spent Arctic, time looking at Arctic foxes.
Arctic foxes, really.
Highly recommend it.
Yeah, really cute. Really cute. But we had a great chat with Jack Carr. It's great to talk to him. We talked to him about that torture scene in the book. Engaging in combat. Great talk. Here he is, Jack Carr.
Day of judgment, God is calling. Underneath the war pigs crawling, begging mercies for the sins. Satan laughing spreads his wings. Oh Lord, yeah.
Yeah,
and now we're locked inside with three kids who are not not very helpful when it comes to say being quiet during time for interviews, especially live radio interviews.
Oh no, really?
So no, it's just everybody's dealing with the same thing. But so we're locked inside, and you know we get out. We're on the mountains, so we go outside for hikes, and you know just go and throw the football in the backyard and that sort of thing. So adapting just like everybody else.
That's good. Yeah, we got to make do with what we got right now. Yeah, we're definitely making sure to get outside, though. I mean, you got to.
Oh, you live in a beautiful area, and we do too, but it helps, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, no, it's so nice to be able to get outside and go on a hike and still stay away from everyone.
I know.
That's right. Although, I got to tell you, man, I was out the other day on a trail, and I saw eight bro dogs pull out of this van and hit the trail, one behind the other. And I hopped off to the side. I'm like, dude, what the hell are you doing? I didn't say anything, but it's like, Jesus, some people just are not getting the message.
Yep, I know. We're not going on the actual trails that are popular around here. We're just going out the back door and just hitting going off trail and then going to the street. We're on a secluded street up in the mountains. So if someone else is walking, we just go to the other side of the street.
Nice.
So we're doing that really out here just to make sure we take the precautions and do our part.
Yeah.
Nice. Good.
That's good.
You grab a machete, do a little bushwhacking. What are you doing there?
Luckily, we don't need it out here. It's in the winter.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Utah. Right. Well, listen, I loved your book, Savage Son. So good. This one had me on the edge of my seat as I read it with its old school throwback Russian bad guy, its twisted torture, Arctic parachuting, killer ants, and man's primordial instinct for hunting and stalking. This one had me up late at night reading it. Really enjoyed it. What inspired you to write this one?
So this is the one I've wanted to write since the sixth grade. The only two things I wanted to do in my life were serve my country as a SEAL and write fiction in this genre. So in sixth grade, we read Most Dangerous Game, which is a short story by someone named Richard Connell, who wrote it in 1924. My daughter's actually reading it for her school right now.
Oh, wow.
So they still do teach this thing.
Huh.
But yeah, it had such an impact on me back then in sixth grade. And I knew that one day I would write a fictional thriller that paid tribute to this classic tale of hunter versus hunted. And it's actually the novel I wanted to write first, although it's the third one in the series.
Right.
But I knew that the characters weren't developed enough it wasn't the book to introduce people to James Reese and this cast of characters. I had to develop them a little bit. And so the first one, all about revenge without constraint in the terminal list. Second one, continuing that journey, really a journey of violent redemption. And then by the end of that story, it was time to write Savage Son, which is the one I wanted to write my whole life. So it was time to explore the dark side of man through the dynamic of hunter versus hunted. So I'm super excited for this one.
That's awesome. Yeah, I remember that short story from years ago reading. I'm not sure if I read it in school, but I don't know when I came across it. But man, that is a great story. And your novel pays great homage to it. So,
Oh, thank you.
Mission accomplished, I would say.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, I love your main character, James Reese. Here's a guy who's motivated by revenge. Now, were you always drawn to characters whose, primary motivator was vengeance?
I was, and that's why I started with it, because I put these six or seven different ideas down on a table when I started writing, and I chose the one that I thought would be the hardest hitting, that was most likely to catch the eye of someone in New York publishing.
Smart.
There's that thing about that theme of revenge that still resonates with us even today, even though we're we're far removed from the campfire and the cave and hunting and defending the tribe. Most people are anyway, but there's still something in our DNA that draws us back to that campfire. It draws us back to that cave. There's something in us that there's still that spark. And so I wanted to tap into that with the first novel, because I mean, there's a reason there's so many Death Wish movies. There's a reason these always do so well. And a lot of it, I think, is because you can't, you know, someone cuts you off in traffic or someone does something horrible to you at work or whatever it is. Like, you can't do that. You can't do all the things you can do in a fictional thriller or in a movie. Like, because you go to jail, you'll get the death penalty. You know, but it feels good to read about them. Or it feels, you know, something about it. So that's why I chose that that theme of revenge without constraint for that first novel. And yeah, I was drawn to those that theme, and so I wanted to explore it a little bit myself.
Awesome.
It really is a powerful thing to think about. I think also it's the equivalent of like the snappy comeback that writers are able to do for us. You know, where you lay in bed and you're like, oh, I should have said that. But in for a writer, you guys can be like, yeah, this is what you should have said, and I'm going to say it.
That's right. You can think about it for a year.
Yes.
Exactly. No, I think we all have that and very almost jealous of people that can come up with those witty comebacks right away instead of when you leave the meeting or leave the conversation and, you know, 10 minutes later, you're like, you know what would have been perfect to say then?
Yeah.
Well, you can make it perfect in a book because you can keep going back to it over and over again to try to get it as good as you can possibly get it.
It is the beautiful part. And when did you first come up with the idea for this character? Was that a long time ago too?
Right. So when I was in the military, I was solely focused on the mission at hand, because you have to be. That's what you owe the guys under your command. That's what you owe their families. That's what you owe the mission, the country. So I didn't think about these storylines or the characters. I just knew that one day I would write in the thriller genre. Mm-hmm. And I've known that since I was a little kid, just like I knew I would be a SEAL. So when I got back from my last deployment and I wasn't going to be taking guys down range anymore, I'd reached that rank where it was time to move on. And you're still a leader, but you're not, it's not like back in the old days where you have a general or somebody that's leading the charge from the front. Once you get past the 04 level, which in the Navy is lieutenant commander and the rest of the services is a major, you're not really leading from the front anymore. You're in a tactical operations center if you're involved in the tactical level of warfare. But you're not going on these operations. You're not kicking in the doors. You're not doing those things anymore. So
the thrill is gone.
What's that?
The thrill is gone.
That's a little bit, yeah. I mean, for sure. But hopefully you're older and wiser, and you know you can allocate assets better, and you understand you know, mission planning process and all that sort of thing. Maybe a little bit. Who knows? But I was at that stage, and I realized that my family needed me, and it was time to get out, move on, take care of my family, and that's where we meet the character James Reese in the first novel. Readers are introduced to him where he's at that same stage. So I was exploring those same emotions that I was feeling with a transition and making that decision. And he's going through that same thing. He's at that stage where he's an 04, he's a lieutenant commander, he's a troop commander. He's on his last deployment and knows that when this one's over, it's time to get out and take care of the family. And so that's where we meet him in the Terminalist. So all those emotions were very fresh in my mind as I started writing that one. And his background is similar to mine in that he was a former enlisted SEAL sniper, which I was. And then he became an officer at some point along the journey. And then he's at that 04 level. And so that's where the similarities really end. Well, I shouldn't say that. He likes his coffee the way I do, which is honey and cream. Because everybody in these genres, they always like their coffee black.
Yeah,
so
they do.
Like, I wanted to humanize the character a little bit. So he likes his coffee the way I do. He likes Land Cruisers. I have an 88 Land Cruiser. So he has the same vehicle. So some of those things kind of to humanize him a little bit. So he's not a superhero. He's good at some things and not at others.
Yeah.
And sometimes people think the SEALs are good at all these different things, like all the spy stuff and all that. Well, maybe not. very good at kicking in doors in the middle of the night and doing the job like that. Yeah. But some of these other things we're not so good at. And so same with him. So I wanted him to be someone that you'd want to have a beer with, that you want to sit down, hang out with, but who could also flip the switch and have the skills and background and training and experience to get it done.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely the way he comes across. Now, how are SEALs at helping their kids with their distance online school learning?
Not good. I can only speak from personal experience. My wife is holding down the fort on that front. Thank goodness. The math is totally different these days.
I know, man.
It's no so hard. One.
They do have these little tricks, though, that they do these days that where they use their hands and their knuckles that are amazing. I think it's for I don't know. I was blown away. I couldn't believe that they did not teach us this back when I was in fifth grade. Because, yeah, right now it's oh man, so much easier.
Yeah.
But no, they're on lockdown, and we're trying to get a good schedule in place where they're doing some free reading and they're doing some arts and crafts and they're doing their schoolwork and we're going on a hike and
that's awesome.
That sort of thing. But you know, we might be falling short on a couple of those because it is complete chaos at all times around here.
Yeah, it really is. And you got to remember that you know, not everything is going to get done. But listen, in your book, Savage Son, I got to tell you, I have read and seen many torture interrogation scenes in my life. But the one that you write in this book, where you got Reese subjecting a prisoner with a little, just a little simple kitchen ingredient and some Navy SEAL ingenuity, just outranks them all. So stellar. That was amazing. Well done. Did you draw on your own experience for that one? That was just phenomenal. It had me squirming, I got to tell you.
Yeah, that was a crazy one.
And yeah.
I did not do that to anyone in real life. You know, okay. Listening from the Justice Department. I've always kind of been fascinated by the torture side of the house. And then of course it came into the limelight with enhanced interrogations and, you know, is it worth it? And then is it worth it when the enemy finds out that you're actually doing this and you're doing it at black sites across the world? Then they can use that as a recruiting tool. At what point does it become counterproductive, based on what intelligence you're getting and all that sort of thing? So right. There's a lot of issues to discuss, the legality of it, the morality of it, the ethics of it. When you have to maintain the moral high ground as the United States. So there's a lot of questions there to explore, which I threw out the window, of course, in the first book and the second and the third, because it's a lot more fun when you're
sure
not sitting
it is,
there
yeah.
hands about it, especially in the pages of a fictional thriller.
Right.
But this fourth one I'm working on now really explores the legality, ethics, and morality of targeted assassinations. Mm. So what we saw with the Soleimani hit in early January, what the Israelis have been doing really mm-hmm. since their country's inception in the mid-40s. So it's an interesting one for me to explore there and then kind of weave those two things together, the enhanced interrogation, the torture. And I like bringing something new. Like the first book, I had someone, and I found out this from the Shining Path guerrilla movement, and they got it from, it's been around for a while, but disemboweling someone and having them walk around a tree as their entrails. So I didn't do that to anybody. These are historical examples of things that, were done in the past. And then they get eaten alive while they're there and their entrails are around the tree. So
I had no idea.
In each book, it's not. So this one you'll see in Savage Son, how you just mentioned it. It wasn't as, let's say, quote unquote, gross or anything. Like it wasn't for the shock value. It was more. So it's a thinking man's torture.
It was. I know. Really, really well done. I enjoyed it. I definitely enjoyed it. But next time I get Mexican food, I'm going to go not for the spicy. I'll tell you. let's just leave it at that and let the readers.
Gotcha.
Yeah,
there was one in True Believer that really stood out as well. So I think in each book, the torture scene has stood out so far. So we'll see if it naturally fits into the storyline in books ahead. But the third one, or the second one, True Believer, has a some piano wire and a rickety stool. And I'll just leave it at.
Oh, yeah. Nice. I've got that book, so I'm going to go back and read that one for sure. That sounds awesome.
Right.
Now, listen, speaking of battle scenes, which we weren't, well, we kind of were, but anyway, just before the crucial battle scene at the end, which was, by the way, amazing.
Thank you.
So well written. Reese is wondering if he is about to embark on a suicide mission. I was curious, like before you went into battle, when you were serving, did you ever have that feeling, or do you not try to let you just can't let that those thoughts creep into your head?
Well, you do think about it because, and it's hard not to, especially so there a couple times. And one was when we were given the mission of protecting the interim Iraqi government. We're doing direct action missions. And I was up in Mosul, but there were SEALs all over the country doing essentially direct action missions, which means, kicking in doors in the middle of the night, going in, grabbing somebody, interrogating them, getting intelligence, building up other, target packages and going out and doing it again. Mm-hmm. Well, then we all got pulled from those missions to go protect protect the Interim Iraqi government, who all had a gigantic bullseye on them. Mm-hmm. And this is about the time when IEDs are starting to show up over there. This is 2004 time frame. We thought, oh, wow, we don't have any training for this. A couple of guys did, not everybody. And now we're supposed to go and essentially do a Secret Service type job protecting some of the most hated people in the world in a war zone. So that was kind of crazy. And most guys did think, wow, this is a suicide mission, because the first guy before Alawi that the United States had kind of picked as the new leader of Iraq, he got blown up. And that's when they called us and had us come in and said, we can't have this happen. We need to, you guys to protect these people. So it was crazy. So that was interesting, setting that up from the ground floor up. And it was something we did for quite some time over there. And then when the IED threat really got bad, especially Ramadi 05, 06, when we left that compound, anything could have been an IED. Mm-hmm. And, as a leader or as anyone, actually, you can either spend your time looking at everything, being afraid you're going to get blown up, or you can just focus on the mission. Right. And of course, you do the best job you can trying to identify things that are IEDs, but they got very good at hiding them over there. So that's where I kind of just took a breath and said, you know what, I'm going to kind of give this up to fate. And if I get blown up, I get blown up. There's not that much I can do about that piece of it. But what I can do is focus my energies on the mission, being the best leader, battlefield leader I can possibly be over here, because that's what I owe the guys. I can't be worried about getting blown up. I have to be the best I can possibly be to make these decisions under fire that are going to have consequences for these guys and their families, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the mentally strong thing to do, because I imagine, I think of Navy SEALs as just being physically strong, but the mental health and the mental strength that it must take to pretty much force yourself to do something that your mind's like, no, you probably shouldn't do that, must be incredible to train your mind to do that kind of thing.
Right. So that's what we're looking really for in SEAL training. And I say any average high school athlete can make it through the training physically. Mm-hmm. Right. We'll get you to the stage you need to be at physically to make it through in the first couple of weeks of running on the sand and doing the obstacle course and doing physical training with telephone poles and these boats that you run around with in Coronado, California during that training. But what we're really looking for is that person with the mental fortitude to really crush anything in their path. So that mental fortitude, that resiliency, that kind of moral type courage. That's what we're really looking for. The amount of push-ups you can do and pull-ups you can do, there's standards for that sort of thing. But like I said, any average high school athlete can show up, and if they don't quit, they're going to get into good enough shape to make it through physically.
Interesting. Do you think the mental strength training that you've had with your background at all has helped you? I'm not comparing writing to being a Navy SEAL, but
but if you were,
do you think that's helped for pushing yourself to do things pretty much on your own to get maybe your first book out and stuff like that? Do you think that helped?
Oh, absolutely. But maybe not in the way you think.
Okay.
It's if you pay attention to the odds, if you were to look at the odds of making it through SEAL training, they're not good. The number of quitters that you get and then the injuries that you can sustain along the way really take a lot of people out of the training program. Mm-hmm. So usually 80% don't make it through.
Oh, wow.
So if you were to look at those odds, and especially before the internet, before you could actually look into this sort of thing, like I thought a SEAL team was like 8 people because of the movie with Charlie Sheen. So I'm like, there's 8 people on a SEAL team. And at the time there were 3 on each coast. And I thought, okay, so that's 8, 16, 24. And my class is starting with 200 and something, 206 people or something like that. I'm going to be in that amount that makes it through. I'll be in that, the 20% that makes it for sure. And that's all the thought I gave to how hard it was going to be to make it through, because I didn't waste any more bandwidth thinking about it. All my bandwidth was focused on getting in as good shape as I could possibly get and then studying warfare, terrorism, insurgencies so I could be the best operator that I possibly could. So I didn't take time worried about not making it through. Same thing with writing.
Yeah.
If you look at the percentages of people ask me all the time, they say, do you know the odds of getting published by Simon & Schuster? And I say, nope, I have no idea because I never paid any attention to those odds. All I did was write the best book that I possibly could. And I knew it would get picked up by Simon & Schuster, by Emily Bessler Books in particular, which is an imprint who published Vince Flynn, publishes Brad Thor. And I knew that she would be my publisher, my editor. And then it would get picked up by an A-list star and a Oscar-winning director for a series. That's all the thought I gave you. Like, that was what I thought, and that is what happened.
Wow.
So yeah, it's a little bit crazy, but I didn't worry about how hard it was. So that's the same thing with SEAL training. I didn't worry about. I knew it was hard. That mm-hmm. was the draw. And for publishing, the draw wasn't that it was hard. The draw was that I love to write. I love this genre. Mm-hmm. I've wanted to do this since I was a little kid. So and then I didn't even really consider how hard it was at all. I just knew that I would do it, and I was lucky enough to have a mom who's a librarian who really. Wow. Gave me this love of reading, and so I was reading books that my parents were reading by fifth grade. So the Tom Clancy Hunt for Red October came out then, and then I was reading all these guys that really became my professors in the art of storytelling. Mm. So David Morrell, who created Rambo in 1972, he's a dear friend now. I mean, it's unbelievable. I was reading Nelson DeMille and A.J. Mm-hmm. Quinnell and J.C. Pollock and Louis L'Amour and then later Dan Silva and Stephen Hunter. And then, I just had this foundation from all which to build because I studied these guys back then. And I didn't just all of a sudden one day decide to do it in my 40s and then go back and read those mm-hmm. things. No, I was reading those guys in the 80s, like at a time when I knew where I was going, at a time when terrorism was taking, especially for a kid my age who was interested in going into the military, the Iran hostage crisis play out with Walter Cronkite on TV. Mm-hmm. Remembering the Time Magazine and Newsweek covers that had the TWA hijackings on there. Remembering the Beirut bombing on the cover of the front page of the newspaper that my dad was reading and looking at that and wondering what was going on over there with both the barracks the bombing and the embassy bombing. Mm-hmm. And all those things in the 80s that really they were a precursor of what was to come on September 11th.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Also, I did notice you give a nice little shout out to Brad Thor in the book. I think you had a character who had one of his books tucked under her arm. But
that's
right. Nice. Yeah. You also have a couple of quick little snarky asides in the book about Navy SEALs who are writers, which I thought was a fun little in joke. Is that the deal? Is inside every Navy SEAL heart beats the heart of a writer? What's going on?
I don't think so, but there are a lot of Navy SEAL nonfiction books out there. So I was just kind of poking fun at that. And of course, some of my dear friends have written some of those books. I love them. I read them, I read them all. And I think that, young people in particular need role models these days. And on social media, there are so many role models that might not be the best for them to be following and emulating. So these books, especially by these guys that like these Medal of Honor recipients that my friend Jocko Willink has on his podcast, where he talks to these guys, they're more recent Medal of Honor recipients, and they talk about their stories. It's absolutely incredible. It's humbling. And I'd much rather have my kids reading books by those guys than buy a book on, something about the Kardashians or something like that. There's anything wrong with being a Kardashian.
No, there is a lot of
Please,
things wrong.
Bash
Come
them.
On, no. There are a lot of things wrong with the Kardashians. For God's right. sakes.
Yeah, well, I'm fine with that.
Let me go out on a limb here and say that. You got some characters that were given nicknames. It sounds like maybe in the military a lot of guys get nicknames. You got a Farkas in there. Were you given a nickname when you served?
That's right. No, if you have a last name or something that doesn't lend itself to a particular nickname, or you don't do something that's crazy. Memorable, yeah. I guess
that's
we'll
funny.
Say. Memorable or crazy, stupid. All those things kind of go together. Looks like they go together most of the time anyway. So if you have a last name doesn't really lend itself to one, then you don't most of the time don't get one. But yeah, it's very common in the military. It's obviously very common in the aviation circles. Those guys all have their their call signs.
Yeah.
And then in the military, just like anything else, just like if you're gonna play football or whatever else, and you have a nickname, same thing in the SEAL team. So I will have a couple backgrounds that were similar to some buddies of mine into the characters in Savage Son, and also wanted to give a shout out to some of their businesses, particularly the dog program. There's a very dog specific part of the novel.
Oh yeah, I love the dogs in this book. Amazing.
They've saved so many lives overseas, just like they do police officers every single day across the country. The canine programs are just incredible. And my friend John Devine at Devine Canines, he runs an incredible program out there. My friend Mike Ritland in Texas does a similar thing where he gives a place where military and police canines can retire, because a lot of times these dogs, they euthanize them. And he gave a, he essentially has a place where they can live out their life on a beautiful ranch. They can get exercise. They're loved out there. And a lot of them, you know, they would not be alive otherwise. So I wanted to kind of weave that into the story a little bit. And we have those guys' backgrounds in there. And then there's a couple other guys that I weave in as well. So it's, they're not just made up out of the blue, although the backgrounds are a little different. They're inspired by people that, that are friends of mine and that, inspired me and that are important to me in my life.
That's cool. Those dogs are great. And they do have some great, you know, adoption programs too, I know, around the country.
Yeah, there's more and more popping up all the time, different foundations. And then there's other ones like Rescue 22, which is an amazing foundation that helps now train service and support dogs for military people that are having issues with PTSD or with a traumatic brain injury or just the physical and emotional trauma of the battlefield. So there's a lot of great groups out there that are using dogs to help people on the outside now.
That's wonderful. So you also had to have these books go through military censors, and we've talked to a couple different writers who have had that. Is that a tough process to go through?
It's such a pain.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Gosh, it's such a pain. Like, they take out things that are not classified in any way whatsoever. In Savage Son, they took out something that I've known since probably seventh or eighth grade. Yeah, it's ridiculous. So, so anyway, I did it with the first three novels. They say they'll get back to you in 30 days. The first one took 45, which I thought was pretty good for bureaucracy. So I submitted the second one. Then 1 month passed, then two, then three, then four, then five, then six. And almost at the 7 month mark, they finally got back to me. Wow. So that one pushed the publication date from April to the summer. And I appealed that one though. So I appealed the second one and I won 37 of the 54 redactions on appeal. So essentially it goes from one person's desk who has the black Sharpie out there, taxpayer funded. And is when in doubt, black it out, I think they say. So they just black out a whole bunch of stuff. And then when you appeal, I think it goes to the next level and they look at it and they still left a few things in there that are not classified or sensitive in any way, but you know, that's just how it goes. So did that with this third one as well, and it took about 7 months, which makes it very difficult for a publisher who is trying to plan a publication date and is juggling other authors' publication dates at the same time. So I don't, even because it's fiction, I don't see how I can possibly continue to submit these things for review.
It does seem unfair.
If they could get back to me in 30 days, that would be nice, and I would, but and if I ever do a nonfiction type thing, if I ever, regardless of what it was, then I would submit and just wait however long it takes. But because these are fiction, I don't see myself continuing to do that going forward, especially when I see the ridiculous nature of what they actually take out.
Yeah. It also, at a certain point, it's your livelihood, and 7 months is absurd.
Yeah.
Well, especially, I mean, people go through this thing and, you know, a few hours, people tell me.
Yeah.
And that's the government. You know, they take a flower reed and they jam it into 7 months.
They are definitely known for that. Yeah.
Well, redactions are not, and they're not really a whole lot. And although there was like just like two pages where I think 90% of the redactions were, I was like, whoa, what the hell happened here? But
so ridiculous. I'm going to appeal this one too.
Okay,
the lawyers just got back to me this morning and said they're going to send over their appeal letter later this afternoon. So I'll get to take a look at that. And really what they do is they tie anything, any sentence that was redacted, they tie it to a publicly available government document, not a something that's already out there on a Wikipedia or someone else's book or something like that. They tie it to a publicly available government document from a government website, a government source that is open source. And we did that to every single redaction. True believer, and they still kept some of them out. Yet you can go to government websites
and find it
that have them. So it's it's pretty ridiculous.
That's frustrating.
Well, I absolutely, redactions or not, I love the book. This is a fantastic book. So exciting. I can't wait to go back and read the other two in the series. And even more than that, we thank you so much for your service.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you guys having me on. You guys are wonderful. And looking forward to doing it again sometime.
Oh, absolutely. For sure. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Thanks, man. Have a great day and good luck with that homeschooling.
Oh, thank you so much. That's probably tougher than SEAL training.
I doubt that.
Take care.
Thank you.
Right, take care.
Bye-bye.
The Inside Flap. Great talk,
yep,
man.
Really enjoyed
really
talking
cool.
to him. Really nice guy.
Yeah, kind of a treat to be able to talk to a former Navy SEAL.
Yeah, it really is. All right, well, let's open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some
book reviews. Laura Medicus.
Laura, what do you have for us this week?
Okay, I have a book called Dreamland by Nancy Bilyeau. It's Bilyeau.
Dreamland. That's where I wished I was instead of inside that infected Walmart.
Inside the Walmart. So I sat and read this book and I barely looked up. Such a great book. So this pandemic has turned me into historical fiction, Laura.
Oh, no more.
I need a new song.
Yeah, this was your old theme
song.
Yeah,
that's my old theme song, Dave. That's historical. An old one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll need to find a historical fiction.
Yeah, I am historical fiction Laura, HFL, if you will.
HFL.
Mm-hmm. So this is excellent historic fiction from a feminist perspective with a murder mystery wrapped up in it. This is set in New York City in 1911, and it takes place during a record hot summer in the Coney Island area. I have never been to Coney Island. Dave, I think you, I mean, we lived in Brooklyn, but I still never went. I had no reason to.
Yeah, I used to, when they would have the Brooklyn half marathon, well, actually, when we were living in Brooklyn, I'd run over to the boardwalk, turn it into like a good 20-mile run, but they would have the Brooklyn half marathon where you'd start on Coney Island and finish in Prospect Park. And
run
through the whole borough of Brooklyn. It was really
That's
nice.
That's cool. Have you been to Coney Island, Andrew?
I have not.
Yeah.
Never been there.
Yeah. And it's, of course, not what it was in 1911. So the main character is a young woman named Peggy Brattenberg. She comes from an extremely wealthy family of American robber barons. So this was the time, this was the age of the Gettys, the Rockefellers, the Vanderbilts, these big, immensely wealthy families. And she's from one of those families. And Peggy is an art lover, she's a book lover, she's a progressive thinking young woman, and she is pretty much forced to go with her entire family and stay at a grand hotel on the ocean for a summer.
Ooh, lovely.
Doesn't seem that bad to me, but you haven't met Peggy's family.
Oh, so, there's the rub right there. Okay.
Yeah. So sometimes with these big robber barons, it's not exactly, they're not exactly nice people, maybe. Maybe you can think of it that way. So while Peggy's here, murdered women keep turning up, family secrets get discovered, some illicit romances brew up. Mm. The historical detail and really just the setting alone is a star for me. And it was enough for me to revel in. But then you throw in a... Sorry, Dave just angled his computer. I gotta tell
maybe,
the listener.
You know, Andrew,
you angled the computer, and I was like, "What is he trying to tell me?" I thought you were writing a note to me.
No,
and then I just see like the name of your book, or like, and you've noted like edits we need to make and stuff like that. And it's also far away.
Edits? We don't edit this podcast. What are you talking about?
It's hard for me to see.
Ah.
And then I look over and I see Andrew's bearded smiling face. Hi, Andrew.
No, I simply thought that while you were giving your recommendation,
you
Andrew
did it so subtly,
like,
and I was like, "Oh, there's a note. He has a note for me to read." It's really funny. It was so distracting.
Speak slower,
louder.
No note. All right, so grand hotels, murdered bodies,
so
showing
listen,
up.
Listen, the setting. All this is amazing, right?
So much. Blood!
Yeah, so much blood.
And it was really enough for me to feel satisfied with in a book. But then the author threw in a murder mystery.
Oh,
so that was just my cup of tea, and
that's
I was hooked.
Bingo! Yes, you gotta have that.
Yeah, so here's really what I loved about this book.
Yes.
I love the details of the way these wealthy families do simple things, like they have their meals, how they get into the ocean. That was a weird production, especially for women in 1911 from a nice family.
Rich people, they're just like us.
Rich people
they
are
eat
not.
And they get, oh, no.
No, they are not at all just like us.
Whoops.
How they, yeah, how they play croquet, like how they try to have fun. And also the way women were treated in families like this was very interesting to read about.
Mm-hmm.
So this grand hotel that was there, it's based on a real hotel. And it was...
you keep reading these hotel and motel books.
I know. That's I don't
like
know what that's about.
Six or seven in a row.
It really is.
That's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Huh. Hotel historical. Historical hotel
historical,
Laura.
Historical. I think you're historical. You're HHL. Historical hotel Laura.
But this hotel, it was, and it is in the book, weirdly close to the masses of Coney Island, which is filled with just kind of... low level.
Yeah, low class people.
Very
yeah.
low class in some cases.
And then, no offense and, to William
although
Boyle
like
and
prostitutes and things
Brooklyn.
Like this. We're talking 1911.
Mm. Ah, yes.
And nefarious people, but also blue collar working class people.
Miscreants.
And I loved, she shows the dichotomy between the classes beautifully. So the wealth of this time period, the wealthy people, they really know elegance. Like, they know how the silver should feel on the table.
Mm-hmm.
They know how the flowers should look at their hotel. They know the weight of the linen tablecloths that should be there. And the working class, they seem to know really how to have a good time. They know how to have some fun, you know, with the money that they have. Yeah. So the description of the title theme park, which is a park named Dreamland, is amazing. And this was a real park. There were three parks that made up the Coney Island area.
Oh,
and
wow.
this was
three
a real park.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And something happens with this park that is historic and in the book, and I don't want to give it away.
All right.
Something that I didn't know. So this park is cheap thrills, it's freak shows, it's rides, food from carts. The Vanderbilts could not believe anyone would buy and eat food from a cart. It's filled with dancing, music, carnival games, exotic animals, and people.
Bearded ladies. How
yes.
about, oh,
yes.
excellent.
It's
all right.
everything
a
wealthy
lady.
Family yes. at this time would look down upon. So I felt like I could feel the spirit of this time period in the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a period with a huge class divide, huge wealth divide, but the working class also had a little bit of spending money, a little bit of free time, and maybe they hadn't before. There's art, there's literature. It's the start of the suffragette movement, because this is before women had the right to vote,
mm-hmm.
but women were really starting to get antsy about that at this point. This is a really enjoyable story about a very particular place and time. And it's a time that seemed like it was so intense and on the verge of, you know, just breaking through to something new. And I think it'd be interesting to pair this book with Alma Katsu's The Deep about the classes on the Titanic.
Oh, sure.
Because
yeah.
one year after this book is set, the Titanic sinks. And
oh,
on
right
the
before.
Titanic was one of the Guggenheims also.
That's
I think
right.
the
yep. mm-hmm.
the elder Guggenheim.
Mm-hmm.
So I love this book. It's called Dreamland by Nancy Billiot. It's brand new, too.
It sounds great. And the most important thing is you're telling me this Dreamland book will not put you into a dreamland.
No. Okay, oh, I stayed up late right. reading this.
Very good.
Couldn't put
great.
It down. Absolutely.
So, Laura.
Yes.
Some useless Titanic trivia.
Oh, yeah.
So I was doing some research on statistics and mm-hmm. the ability to correlate data.
Okay.
And, wow, and riveting.
It
stuff.
Is riveting.
Man.
Yep. And so somebody has done some correlation analysis on the Titanic.
And the show has reached
and
a new
they
low.
They did the correlation analysis on the class of passenger, whether you are male or female,
mm-hmm.
and basically things along those lines. And essentially they could tell – you know, with 99% certainty whether you would survive the Titanic or not.
Oh,
that is interesting.
That's fun.
Based on sex and also the class of the class of the passenger.
Wow.
So obviously, the more you paid for the ticket,
sure, higher your
the
odds.
More likely you were to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you were a female as well, you also had greater odds of survival. But you know, it's also a study that looks at the fact that there were just such difference in classes. I mean,
yeah.
like, sure, we've got first class and mm-hmm. we've got coach, but I mean, essentially, it's mostly the same people, or at
well,
least we'll tell
it's,
ourselves
it's the
same people.
That is a little bit the same people. I think it's more the equivalent of like the private jet, like people who can just take a private jet wherever they want to go.
Right. Well, nobody's taking a private jet anywhere. Right
they tried. They're trying to. they're getting turned around, evidently. That's interesting, Andrew. Yeah, the Titanic's a beautiful presentation of the levels of class, just because they had very clear defined areas of first, you know, second and third.
And did you determine that you would survive the Titanic, Andrew, or that you would not?
You know, I think I would have been the Leonardo DiCaprio of the Titanic.
So. I like that.
That's a no.
So all that right. would be a no.
That would be a no.
Katie would not have moved over on that lifeboat.
No, she would not have.
No.
Sorry, there is no room.
Said, is there room? Is no room? And she would have said, nope.
Sorry. Sorry.
So, and I would have taken that necklace with me to the grave.
All right. Well, speaking of historical fiction, my book,
Dave Medicus,
a little historical fiction aspect to it. Now, my book is written by Max Allen Collins, and the name of it is called Do No Harm. Now, Max Allen Collins has written a ton of books, including, he wrote the graphic novel that the Road to Perdition movie was based on. Hmm. He's also written CSI novels, Dick Tracy books, novelizations of movies such as Saving Private Ryan and American Gangster. And now he stated in interviews that these are examples of books that, quote, put bread on the table. And you know, authors got to do that.
Sure.
But the book I'm recommending
Hi,
is
Will Smith.
Do
Will
No
Smith
Harm.
Knows how to do that.
And this one features this author's favorite character, and he has written a number of books featuring him. He's an old school, hard boiled private investigator, a Sam Spade / Philip Marlowe type named Nathan Heller. And what the author does with him in this series, now there are over 20 books in this series. So what he will do is he will take Nathan and drops him, this old school private eye type guy, he drops him into famous, well-known mysteries of the past century, and then he uses the real names of all the players involved, but places his fictional detective at the forefront
Question.
Of the story. Yes.
Is there time travel involved, or is it just
it's just a plot device. Okay, yeah, so gotcha. When it opens up, like,
that's cool.
His detective is living in this.
It's a good idea
time
just to take liberties
oh,
with
what a great idea.
Another question, does
the
he
historical
have like
private story,
does he have like a family or a girlfriend that also gets dropped into that plot, or is he a lone wolf?
No, he's alone. Come on, he's okay. Sam Spade type. Right. You think Sam Spade's gonna be
You're
messing
right.
around with
no.
any family? Hell no.
No.
Certainly not in this one. Now, I'm lucky. I'm excited because this. I just now discovered
you
this
a series.
Author.
Yeah,
so I've got 20 books to look forward to
wow.
reading, and man, I can't wait. Some
That's
of the
cool.
some of the mysteries he's dropped Nathan Heller into include the Lindbergh baby mystery, how Marilyn Monroe died, what happened to Amelia Earhart. You know, the classics, the classic mysteries.
Huh.
And in fact, before I go ahead with my recommendation of
he
this
has
book,
it,
and we'll talk about it.
The author has an Elton John look.
He's got a real, he does have a real Elton John look to him.
Yeah.
Go on Goodreads, Max Allen Collins.
Mm-hmm.
Just need some sunglasses.
He's
maybe.
Got the, in the picture I'm seeing, there's some sunglasses.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Let me see.
Oh, I can turn my laptop towards you.
Oh, yeah. Look at that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Dead ringer.
Yep, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I would say that he writes books just the way Elton John writes music. How about that?
Wow.
Yes, both masters of their craft. But anyway, before I tell you about the book, I'm curious to know what you guys... So if I was writing this series, or if I could go back in time to solve a mystery,
uh-huh.
I would want to go back to 1963 and solve the JFK mystery,
yeah.
personally.
Yeah.
Or get him, see, you know, dig around a little bit, see what's going on. Snoop around that grassy knoll.
That's a good
see
one.
What the hell's going on. Laura, what about you?
Oh, man. I mean, you took one that's like the most, that's the
well,
big
yeah,
American
that's the,
mystery,
that's the go-to.
I feel like.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a really good one. Mine would be based on a book that I read and loved last year.
Bigfoot?
Called The Murderer's Maid by Erica Mailman.
Oh, right. Yeah,
I would
Lizzie
like
Borden.
To know
yes.
if Lizzie Borden killed
if
her
she
parents.
She really did it. Mm.
If she did it.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Go back in there, get inside that house, see what's going on.
I'd like to know.
Grab that wax. Grab that axe.
Oh,
yeah,
wax.
Look for blood on that axe.
I would like to know. And that's also just based on the books. The book was so good. And I was like, oh, what happened?
Yeah, and you could question the maid, question the everyone involved.
Yeah.
Get to know the neighbors. Yeah. Andrew, what about you?
So I would actually steal a premise from a science book fiction book I read.
Ah.
Ooh,
and in this book, there was a
shocker.
Yep. I know. Sacrilege.
No,
sacrilege.
No, no. But, I'm kidding.
But in this premise, there was a woman, and she was talking with a guy who was a chauvinist. And basically, she wanted to teach him a lesson. So she took this chauvinist, and she was able to force him to time travel. And so she sent him 200 years in the past. But you could only send the consciousness of the person. And she sent him to live as a woman 200 years in the past.
That's good.
So you're saying you would want to live as a woman 200 years ago?
Oh, no, no, no. But it was an interesting premise. And of course, the guy, you know, that was this story.
Yeah.
Was just talking about the transformation of this individual from going through that experience. Mm.
Now, how about a classic American mystery?
I'm just not a mystery, you know, need to solve the mystery kind of person.
Okay. All right. Very good.
You would, I mean, you're curious about JFK, though, I'm sure.
I am, but, you know, I already know what happened to JFK. So, you know, I think Lyndon B. Johnson took him out. and that's why Lyndon Johnson was taken out a few weeks after he was done with office.
That's right. We watched that videotape. We know what's going on from that coroner. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyway, so this book, Do No Harm, is the latest one in the Nathan Heller series. It just came out. And this one is all about the Sam Shepard case. Now, Andrew, Now, I'm not talking about the playwright who unfortunately just passed away.
Sam Shepard, I thought about.
And he was a great actor, mm-hmm. too, in his own right. But, Andrew, do you know the Sam Shepard case?
I do not.
All right. Well, allow me to play this audio clue for you. And then afterwards, I'm going to ask you that same question again. Here we go.
What I want out of each and every one of you is a hard target search of every gas station, residence, warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
The Fugitive.
Yes, that obviously is from The Fugitive. And The Fugitive revolved around the Sam Shepard case. Now, Sam Shepard, I had no idea. All I know about this guy was, you know, from the old TV show and then from the movie. I don't think I ever saw the old TV show, actually, but from the movie, and there was a one-armed man involved. But, however, apparently in real life, the doctor, Sam Shepard, he went to jail for killing his wife, but never became an actual fugitive from justice. Now, I also had no idea what a huge deal this case was, but this book really brought it to life in living color, and I got to experience it firsthand. I could not put this book down. Not only was it tremendously entertaining, but it's also funny. This is Nathan Heller character. He really knows his way around. Oh, I mean, if you're going to have an old school private investigator, he's got to know how to crack wise, right? Mm. It just goes along with the job description. If you can't deliver a wise crack when needed, there's no point in being an old school noir private eye. But also the historical detail in this book is fascinating. I also did not know that F. Lee Bailey cut his teeth on this case. He represented Sam Shepard at his retrial. And kind of got wide renown for his questioning techniques. I just knew him from the OJ case.
Yeah, same here.
I love the intermingling of the real life with the fictional hardboiled detective. And then in the afterword of the book, the author goes into great detail. He gives you all the books he read while researching. He's like, if you want to know more about it, read this book, read this book. I mean, like 20 books that he's recommending all about the Sam Shepard case.
I love stuff like that.
Fascinating historical tidbits in the book.
Hey, like, Dave, are you historical fiction Dave?
I might be. I might be. But listen to this. Did you know this? Elliot Ness lived nearby and was at the scene of the murder.
Really?
Yes.
And
right after
she was murdered?
Uh-huh. And did you also know that Earl Stanley Gardner, the creator of the Perry Mason books, he got involved with the case? And also, only a few days after Sam Shepard was convicted of killing his wife, his mother killed herself. And his father died about a week later, right after that. This book is all about, and it tells the case, how the doctor, he awoke, and anybody who's seen the movie or the TV show knows what happened. He woke up one night to discover his wife had been murdered, and he's fending off this mysterious stranger who, in the book, I guess in real life also, he described him as having bushy hair. Might have been two people, might have been one. He was knocked out a couple of times. The case went to trial, was a national sensation, and he was basically convicted for her murder before it even came to trial. He was convicted by the press and the public.
Yeah, because usually the husband's
right away.
Husband's the one.
Exactly, and that's the first person they went to, and that was the lead investigator. That was his immediate thought.
Sure.
And he wasn't even looking at other angles.
No.
And he just wanted the facts to match up to his idea. I mean,
it's pretty much always the husband.
Well, in this case, there is a hell of a lot more to the story than just that.
That sounds
great,
Dave.
No shortage of suspects on who could have murdered his wife. It seemed a lot of people had opportunity and motive, including the doctor himself. And we get a courtside seat to the proceedings thanks to Nathan Heller, PI to the past. He likes his liquor like he likes his women, intoxicating and tantalizingly tart. He's half Jewish, half Irish, but he's 100% compelling, as is this book. Now, this is one where you spend half your time enjoying reading it, and then you spend the rest of the time enjoying Googling all the historical information.
Yeah, the true crime stuff.
This is old school, but not old hat. This is historical noir with a charming PI and an engrossing mystery. I love this one. Check it out. This is Do No Harm by Max Allen Collins, and I cannot wait to dip back into the earlier books in this series. So, so good. Just really, really fast-paced and just so entertaining. Really good. I enjoyed it. And that is recommended by
Dave Medicus.
So there you go. Check that one out. Now, Andrew.
Andrew Dowd.
What do you got for us this week?
So I reached back into the archives of some of my favorite novels.
Mm-hmm. Another Ayn Rand book for us?
As a matter of fact, no.
Okay. All right.
So, this book is by Arthur C. Clarke. It was written in
1973. Never heard of him. Just kidding.
Who's this Arthur C. Clarke?
When was it written? I'm sorry, Andrew.
Laura, you might want to look this one up. This book has won a few awards. The book is titled Rendezvous with Rama.
Oh, you know, I don't know this.
So,
Rendezvous with who?
With Rama. And so going back, I mean, it's hard to believe this book is nearly 50 years old. Huh. And some of the concepts in this book, it's just amazing. Arthur C. Clarke was just so ahead of his field as a science fiction, novelist.
He really was.
Yeah, and to a certain extent, the film 2001 A Space Odyssey was partially based on Rendezvous with Rama.
Hmm.
Right? But this book was profound back in its time, and it definitely deserves a read. And so have you discovered anything on Rendezvous with Rama? It's won a few awards.
Yep, Hugo Award for Best Novel, Nebula Award, Locus Award, British Science Fiction Association Award. All the major ones. The biggies.
Just a couple.
just a few.
And so the premise of this book, and I don't want to give too much away, is that an asteroid strikes the Earth in Italy, and it ends up killing 600,000 people. And so as a result of this, the planet, and this is in the year like 2177, right? So it's in the not too distant future. And so, 150 years or so from now. And so they create Space Guard, whose job it is to basically search the solar system looking for asteroids and comets and things like that that could strike Earth. Hmm. So they happen to discover a celestial object, which ends up becoming known as Rama. And so Rama is basically named after a Hindu god. And Rama, as a Hindu god, he is the symbol of sacrifice. He is symbolic of brotherhood, of an efficient administrator, and an unparalleled warrior, right? So Rama
A worrier or a warrior?
Andrew has that accent.
A worrier.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can read this book because I think I would just keep singing Rama Lama Ding Dong.
Oh, that's fun. Oh, great. Thank you, Dave.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Yeah, nice. I think somebody spent a little too much time indoors. So he's like, you know, Rama, the god Rama is like.
See, you started singing it.
the most supreme Hindu god, right? And so that's what they name this object. Now, this object, it turns out, is 10 trillion tons. And they discover it's moving towards Earth, not on a collision course, but they know it is going to be passing close to Earth and it's heading for the sun. And so as they research this object, they realize that it's hollow and they realize that it is not artificial. And the size of this object, I mean, 10 trillion tons, it is 30-some miles long, you know, and so basically they put a crew together on the spaceship Endeavour, and there are 50 people on Endeavour, and they are going to have 3 weeks to investigate this object.
Are they going to go up there? Are they oil workers, and they're going to go up there and drill it and put a Oh, wait, that's I'm thinking of Armageddon.
Different script, okay. Yeah.
Different script. Bruce Willis. Sorry.
So what's phenomenal about this book is it's the sense of wonder and the sense of awe from this book. You know, what are they going to find? Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and you know, this book answers the question, are we alone?
Oh. You know,
are we alone in the universe? And
love
so
that.
But then, of course, once we answer the question of are we alone, then there's a lot more questions like, well, what are those people like? Are they good?
Yeah.
Are they evil?
Do they want to kill us?
Do they want to kill us?
And, yeah.
Do they want to eat us?
All those things work themselves out in the pages of this book. And so inside the 30-some mile spaceship, there is an Earth-like atmosphere. There are oceans, there are fields, there are entire cities with skyscrapers. And so this crew, and Commander Norton is the gentleman leading the crew. And so they make their way in there, and it is a voyage of discovery. And they talk about philosophy, and they talk about religion. And of course, there is this battle between paranoia and science. You know, there's no indications that these people mean us any harm, but there's always the potential that they could harm us.
Well, is an age-old problem we have with the other, you know, be it Russians during the Cold War or Mexico now. People have that. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Well, it's human nature.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, I think it's one of the good things about a great book, whether it's science or historical fiction, is it kind of gets to the essence of human nature, you know, and whether it was 3,000 years ago or 3,000 years in the future, human nature is not going to change.
That's true.
We're still going to have the same paranoia. We're going to have the same fears.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, you think even the pandemic now, well, 105 years ago, I mean, we were going through the same thing, a similar situation, but, this book is fast-paced. There is danger in this book. There is sacrifice. And, you know, it helps to answer the question of, are we alone? And, you know, and what kind of things are out there? But this book, especially considering that it's 50 years old, is just unbelievably epic. And I don't know that I've reviewed an Arthur C. Clarke book on this show.
I do not believe you have.
I don't think you have, yeah.
But maybe one of your other podcasts, but not on this one.
But. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, one of my other ones for sure.
Yeah,
but this book is phenomenal. Let me hear. You got so excited.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, this book is phenomenal, and it is epic, especially considering when it was written. And this book still holds its own 50 years later. But the book is Rendezvous with Rama, and if you are a fan of science fiction, this book deserves to be on your reading list.
Nice.
great. I have not read that one. I think
have
I'm
you
more,
read any Arthur C.
I think
Clarke?
I've read some Arthur C. Clarke short stories.
I've read
but
short
I've
stories.
Never,
I've never read a book.
No, might be a good time to dip in to a little Arthur C. Clarke.
Is he one of your favorites, Andrew, in terms of the big names?
You know, he is, but it really comes down to there's a few of his books that I've read that are very profound.
Mm-hmm.
And these are books that leave you thinking, right? Mm-hmm. That makes you wonder. And that's what I love about Arthur C. Clarke. And whether it's Rendezvous with Rama or Childhood's End, another one of his books that I absolutely love. I mean, it's just simply, you are struck, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you are struck with this sense of wonder and questioning about the universe and existence, and what might be from reading books like that. And that is some of what I think is the best in science fiction. And I don't know that there's anybody else out there that writes quite like Arthur C. Clarke that is just able to kind of instill, you know, those feelings, from the simple pages of a book.
Sounds great.
Yep. Sounds really good. All right. Very good. Well, let's get to it. It's time for the
audiobook of the week.
And I welcome in another author who's enjoyed some time in the audiobook of the week segment, Don Winslow. This book is broken. It's brand new. Just came out. Now, Don Winslow.
Is the book broken or is that the title?
The book is not broken, but it is broken.
Okay.
Which is to say the title of the book is broken. But it's not broken. There's nothing. This is like an Abbott and Costello routine. I don't know if he intended it like that. But no, the name of the book is Broken.
Cool.
Okay. So Don Winslow, in my mind, is the greatest crime. Now, there's a lot of great crime writers writing today, but Don Winslow is at the top of the pyramid right now. He's the author of the popular The Cartel trilogy, as well as The Force, a novel I really enjoyed about cops and corruption in New York City. Broken is not a novel. It's six short novellas. So they're all longer than short stories, but they're not quite full-length novellas. Listening to them, each one clocked in at a little under 2 hours. And
wow,
each one of
that's
them,
long.
Well, not when you think about it, you're listening to an audiobook, you got maybe 10 to 15 hours of listening.
Okay.
So a novella, around 2 hours.
I gotcha, yes. Clearly.
Each one of these novellas is riveting. They're small masterpieces. Each one could have easily been expanded into novels of their own. Some of them revisited characters from Winslow's other books, but definitely this is can be read as just a standalone. You don't have to have any prior knowledge of any of these other characters. But it did enhance my listening pleasure hearing some of the other characters. So I'll quickly give you a brief rundown on what each one is about. The first one is just a straight-up revenge story, brilliant in its simplicity and execution, about a cop who avenges his brother's death. The second is called Crime 101. This was a really fun one. This is a cat and mouse affair about a jewel thief looking for that one last heist and the old school cop who's out to stop him. And just when you thought that these are all going to be like some kind of variations on old themes, the third novella is called The San Diego Zoo, where the criminal in this case is a chimpanzee with a gun, and it is hilarious. Next is Sunset. It's about the bail bondsman business. Now, this one brings back some characters from the Dawn Patrol, his PI surfing book that I really liked. Next one is Paradise. This revolves around crime syndicates in Hawaii, featuring characters from his great book, Savages. And the final story...
Magnum P.I.
The final story is called The Last Ride. Now, this one deals with something that I know Don Winslow, in real life, feels passionate about and has spent a lot of time on his social media. He's taken out full-page ads in the New York Times about this, railing about against it. It's all about how immigrant parents and their children are getting separated at detention camps along the Mexican border. It's really, really good and a great way to
end. I didn't know that about him, that he'd taken out ads and stuff.
These stories are thought-provoking, they're emotional, they're funny. Nobody writes about crime as well as Don Winslow does right now, and it shows in these stories. Let's take a listen to a clip. This is Broken by Don Winslow, read by Ray Porter and Kaleo Griffith.
But when Jimmy did have to go, it would take a whole squad of brother officers to pull him off. He once wrecked an entire crew of bubbas who came down from Baton Rouge. and got rude in Sweeney's, Jimmy's neighborhood bar. They went in vertical and loud, went out horizontal and silent. Jimmy McNabb had been one tough street cop, like his daddy before him. Big John McNabb was a legend. Both his sons had no choice to be anything but cops. Not that either wanted to be anything else.
Now, there you go. You can listen to that. Nobody reads tough guys like Porter does. Mm. And interesting, now listen to this. As I looked up this guy for tonight, you know, as we're recording this, I looked him up. He also read Jack Carr's Savage Son book.
Yeah, that's
Ray
cool.
Porter. So he's got
he's the tough guy.
He's the tough guy. Yeah, you want a tough guy, you get Ray
that
Porter.
Guy.
That's right.
Ray Porter. That's
Ray
a good tough guy.
Porter.
Name.
It really is. And you hear it there. Yeah, he can really bring it. I love this book. There's another example of the dogs getting more in shape because I just could not stop listening. So we walked a few extra blocks on our walk so I can get some more listening time. And so good. Cannot recommend it highly enough. Broken by Don Winslow. And that is your
audiobook of the week.
And that's our show for this week. Thank you guys so much for listening. We really appreciate it. If you don't mind, hey, listen, go ahead and tell a friend. Why not? You know, spread it around a little bit. Let's get people reading out there. Mm-hmm. We try to bring some good books for you every week, interesting interviews.
Oh, and sometimes we have an inside chat, sometimes we don't. So
that's
sometimes
right.
If we have an extra author or two,
we'll stick them in
we'll
midweek.
Put them in midweek. If we don't, we won't.
That's right, but always the show
we'll
that we put out Sunday are the ones where we
always
recommend books.
Always have Paris.
And usually have an author on these ones too. So thank you so much for listening. Thanks to Jack Carr for dropping by. We appreciate it. We appreciate you. Thank you. Have a great week.
Adios.
National isolation breeds national neurosis. Hubert H. Humphrey. I already know what happened to JFK.